It's time to get it, and you know how we get it. Americano, the podcast about all things business and personal growth with your host, Eric Vonheim.
Today, I would like to welcome Josiah Lilly to the show. Josiah, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Eric. How are you doing?
Fantastic. I woke up today, so that's always a good step in the right direction.
Vertical's the best way to be.
I feel like if you can just kind of set your expectation to waking up each day, being healthy and alive, and the sun is shining, like you're already at an advantage.
You know, it's funny. I meditated this morning, and I haven't meditated. I've gone through periods where I've meditated very, very regularly, and I haven't done so in the last couple of months, just for being been moving and doing some other things. And this morning, I'm like, I need to meditate. And after I meditated, I felt just like did a quick 10-minute meditation, but it felt so good. It was like at 5:30 in the morning, just to kind of ground me, get me present, and feel connected.
Yeah.
It's just funny how just taking even a few minutes to kind of be present for the day and sets the mood for the day and kind of get your energy dialed in. It really reminded me how valuable of a tool that is.
Ooh, that's a great place to start, meditation. So I've always been fascinated about meditating, but I don't know how to approach it. Like, for example, it's very difficult for me to just slow my mind down and have like peace or what they say, clearing of the mind. So is that something you struggle with, or do you kind of, can you put yourself in that state right away? Do you choose to focus on something in the process?
I've used a lot of guided meditations, which are kind of give you things to think about. But, you know, no matter, my experience has been that no matter who is the one doing the meditation, they always use the breath as one of the key elements, right? Just kind of focus on your breath.
Yeah.
And they say thoughts come in and out, and that's completely fine. It's to be expected. No matter how much of an experienced meditator you are, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You're just aware of them, but they're kind of like clouds. They come into your presence. You see that they're there, and you let them move along, and you get back to focusing on your breathing. So I don't think it's a state of complete hyper-focusedness. Yeah. It's actually a state of just being and letting thoughts come and being aware that something came into your mind, letting it go. It's not owning you, and then getting back to your breathing. I find that the breathing part, just kind of focusing a lot on that, is the simplest way to kind of dial it in. And just it gets a little more natural as time goes on.
I love that. You know, you're the first person to have explained to me that those thoughts, which when I meditate, I'm like, go away, go away, go away, right?
Yeah.
You're the first person to have explained to me that, really treat them as clouds moving. They're coming in, they're coming out, and get back to focusing on breath. I like that. So when you start the day by meditating, what do you think that does for you? Do you feel like it just gives you the foundation that you need to go chase down all the different things that you want to do? Because we're going to learn today that you're a busy man. Like, you got a lot of things going on. And ever since I've known you, like, you've been that person. Like, and so I really want to kind of peel this onion back around, you know, what are the things that you're doing in your day to day that enable you to drive as hard as you do?
So I have a lot of energy, and I wake up historically in the morning, and my goal is to get out of the house as fast as humanly possible. Like, there are time periods where I kept my head shaved, so I didn't have to even waste time, like, really styling my hair. Right? I just want to get the hell out of the house and get my day going.
Yeah.
And then I got into a bit of a routine for a while that I would wake up, I would meditate, I would go downstairs, I have a rower, I would jump my rower for about 10 minutes, get a good little sweat going, jump my sauna for 15 to 20 minutes, and then jump in a cold plunge for 4 minutes. And it was hard for me because it was about a 45 to 55 minute routine, depending how diligent I was about getting it done, which is completely against my nature. I should wake up, get the hell out of the house. I got so much energy. Let's go. So to put myself in more of a pause mode to become kind of present is never easy for me, or definitely not, does not come naturally for me. I have to kind of force myself. But a day like today, I naturally want to wake up and just go. Let's go. What's on? And my mind just wants to start racing. So what it forces me to do is, before I let the madness of what every day consists of take me over, I take a few moments just to kind of be there for myself, get myself grounded, kind of take some deep breathing, just kind of soothing my soul almost, and preparing myself for the day so that I don't just go into a state of emergency or just not even, maybe emergency is not the right word, but just in that state of constant rush and go and go and go and go, you know, just at least before it gets to that place, I had my moment of,
yeah,
of serenity and of peace and of my Zen for the
your
moment.
Your Zen moment.
Yeah.
Your Zen moment. Have you always been like that? Meaning popping out of bed and just ready to go?
Yeah. I always wake up with just a lot of energy. I'm dancing around the house.
You're dancing.
And singing at 5 a.m. And I've just been blessed, or I guess depending on who you talk to, blessed or cursed.
Blessed or cursed. It's either a blessing or a curse.
Yeah. Some exes might have wished I wasn't so energetic in the morning. But yeah, I've always had just really high energy in the morning. And just, I'm a high energy person normally, but in the morning, just I feel fresh. I always wake up. Very rarely am I ever groggy. I always wake up feeling good.
You're ready to go. So it's not the Celsius.
No, it's not.
Okay. All right. So let's peel this back a little bit, because what we've learned already is that, you know, you're high energy, but yet you meditate on purpose to establish a solid foundation for your day before all the madness, so to speak. And we understand that this is probably part of your DNA. So why don't we go back in time a little bit and talk about where you're born and your upbringing a little bit.
So I was born in Tennessee.
Tennessee, you know, that's a booming place right now.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually a lot of production being done in the tile world, a lot of porcelain tiles, so there's a lot of factories, a lot of opportunities for companies to get some incentives from the state to move their manufacturing there. So yeah, there's a lot going on in Tennessee.
Yeah, so you're born in Tennessee.
I was born in Bristol, Tennessee.
And how long did you spend out in Tennessee?
So I lived in Tennessee until I was about 2. My mom's from Tennessee, and my dad's from West Virginia. Moved to West Virginia when I was 2. My brother was born there. And then at the age of 11, I had just turned 11, we moved to California, moved to Fountain Valley, California.
That was a big change.
That was a really big change. And all of, especially back there, coming from a very traditional family, a lot of Southern, you know, old Southern, I guess, hospitality and
or mannerisms
and all like that Southern culture.
Yeah.
All of our family thought we were losing our mind. Like my grandparents on both sides, and we were very, like, you know, we had half family in West Virginia, half the family in Tennessee, and we always got together for family events, and we were very connected. Because the crazy part is, my mom's the baby of 7, my dad's a baby of 4. The 2 oldest siblings met, and they fell in love and got married. Then the middle siblings, over a course of time, fell in love, got married.
Yeah.
Then my parents fell in. So three from my father's side, married 3 from my mother's side. So it sounds pretty incestuous. It's not, but it's, so I've got a bunch of cousins who are double cousins. Our mom and dad are brother and sister, and our dad, mom, brother and sister.
Yeah, like a double cousin status. Yeah, that's impressive. Crazy.
So our families were very, very connected and very tight. Yeah. So when my father told the family that we're moving to California, they were like, that's the land of the devil.
They couldn't understand it.
You're going to fall off the edge of the earth, earthquakes. I mean, you know, they were all just terrified of what we were doing.
Oh,
And I look back and I'm so incredibly grateful that we moved, because California really changed my life and opened me up to so many different opportunities and different cultures and different experiences that I don't know how that would have all played out had
in
I
Tennessee.
Stayed back there.
And isn't it interesting that, you know, a couple of things that you shared prompted me to think about. Number one, it's very interesting that you say our parents' generation, they come from a time where you would have a lot of siblings, big families. Like even my mom, you know, there's like 6 of them, right? And nowadays you would have generally smaller families. And maybe there's a whole host of reasons for that. And the second thing is that, isn't it interesting that the decisions that our parents make at those pivotal moments in time can change the trajectory of our lives? Right. Just think about it, because you're in Tennessee and then at 11 years of age, it just sets you off in a totally different course. Right.
Yeah. My brother and I often talk about, I wonder what our lives would have been like if our father didn't have the courage to make such a bold move to move across the country. Right. So it's a long ways away, and to move at a place where we had no other family. You know, everything was kind of centered back there between West Virginia and Tennessee. And so to make that move and to leave all of their siblings and their parents and to move out, just the 4 of us, to California was a really, really ballsy move.
Yeah.
Especially when you know more about the way I was raised. So we're just very grateful, and think about how different our life potentially could have been, especially because we were living in West Virginia. It's a pretty depressed state.
Yeah.
You know, Tennessee's a different state, but West Virginia's a pretty depressed state. Even going back and visiting in the years since, it's got some beautiful hills and trees, but
it's totally different.
I'm very glad I don't live there.
Totally different. I always wonder how much weather plays a role in some of these states, especially in the mid and the East Coast, right? And I always think about myself, like, we're very fortunate to live in California where it's, you know, I would say the majority of the time it's quite beautiful, right? Albeit we've had some rain recently. But could you imagine how much more competitive the middle America, East Coast states would be if they just didn't have to deal with weather, like snow and all that stuff? It probably like pulls them back in their productivity, right?
I would certainly imagine so. I mean, think how much we're impacted after a week of rain or what got done during that week, even being outside and being active and sports or just functioning. You know, we're not used to it. Other states, of course, have it all the time, and so they're forced to deal with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think that weather plays a big part in the mental edge and kind of like the focus and the energy of a state.
Yeah. You feel moody, like when the weather is like not that good, you feel a little bit edgy, like, don't mess with me, don't bug me, I'm just trying to get through this. Like it changes the way that you feel and how you kind of interact with others, right?
I believe at one time the highest suicide rate was in Washington.
Was Washington?
Yeah, because
about Alaska?
One of the rainiest but yeah, a place like that. But where it rains so many days during the year, you know, there was a really high suicide rate because you're limited in going outside and what you can do. And if you're inside, I mean, you're going to probably eat or drink or, I don't know. I'm glad.
Well, thank God you got out of Tennessee. I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. So you're 11 years of age. You end up in Fountain Valley and it's just palm trees and sunshine all around you.
Yeah, it was, I almost wish I could.
What was that first day? I mean, let's take this back a little bit. You must have some fond memories, some teenage memories around that time when you showed up on the scene, because that is 180 different.
Well, it's really different because where we lived in West Virginia was down a long, long road, and our closest neighbor was probably, I don't know, half a mile away, maybe further.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah, so, so there are aspects of that were cool. But yeah, it was much more remote, obviously, extreme to an extreme degree. So coming to California and being able to get on our bicycles and ride down to the local store. This was kind of a funny thing. We went down to the local, when my grandmother would call and go, hey, where are the boys? And my mom would say, oh, they went down to the liquor store to get some candy. Well, the liquor store in Tennessee, you buy liquor, right? It's a liquor store.
It's a dedicated liquor store,
it's
right?
It's not like
California.
Correct. So when they would, like, you let your 11-year-old go to a liquor store, like, what the hell is going on? You have on all the, you know, the devil does have you. But no, they had to explain that. No, a liquor store is like a mini mart. Yeah. But just to be able to jump on your bicycle and have access to those kind of places, or just be able to cruise around and have, you know, I got a paper route at a very young age and started my first real job was a paper route. So having access to those kind of things and just being able to, or going to the beach, and I learned how to surf, all of those things that would never have been on, you know, on an opportunity for me back in Tennessee or West Virginia specifically, was amazing. And then another big thing was the cultures, right? You don't have near the exposure to culture back in West Virginia that you would have in Tennessee. You didn't have all the Asian cultures and the Hispanic cultures and just such a huge mix of people here that you get to rub shoulders with and learn from that you don't have back there, at least not to the degree here.
Yeah, and that really rounds you out. You know, it's interesting you point that out, because I feel like that was one of the things that was fantastic in my childhood. You know, I was originally born and raised in Northern California. So I was born in Santa Rosa. And I don't have a lot of context as to what it would have been like living outside of California. So, you know, driving to the liquor store or on my bicycle, that was like, of course, that's what you do, right? But also we grew up around a lot of different people that were a mix, different than us, different families, right? And different cultures. And I always felt, I never looked at it through that lens that you would see it today, because I just saw them as friends. And that's just, everybody's different and it's fun and it's cool. But, you know, in hindsight, when you look back now, you realize that was such a benefit, because it allows you to learn about others and now you can interact more effectively. You can be better in society when you get a chance to interact with people that are just different than you, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It forces you And I say force is because you're required to do it, not because it's a bad thing, just to try and get some sort of common ground, understand their culture, understand the differences that makes them unique, and maybe some things about their culture you like more than your own culture.
100%.
Right? So you kind of get this benefit of getting this melting pot of different influences that kind of then can become part of your DNA.
Yeah, I love that. So you show up to Fountain Valley, the sun is shining, you're already in your bicycle headed to liquor stores. I mean, the trajectory is looking good. I did hear that you got a job with, you were doing paper? You're selling newspapers? Or are you tossing them? Now, is that what you're doing on your bicycle? You're doing a paper route?
Yeah. I had a paper route for the Daily Pilot was my first one.
Really?
And I think the cool thing about having a paper route, there's different layers to the responsibility. So you had to learn to wake up early in the morning.
Yes.
Get up, fold all your papers, then get them all delivered in time. And then at the end of the month, this was obviously a daily pilot, no pun intended, a daily responsibility. Then at the end of the month, you had to go collect for the papers.
Yes.
So you had to go knock on people's doors, make sure that they were paying their bills. Someone didn't want to pay or didn't have the ability for whatever reason. You had to kind of make note of that, go back. You know, there was a whole process to it. So when you're 11, 12 years old, learning these different layers of business, it was a cool, I look back on it with very, very fond memories.
Yes. But that's where you really learn.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I have a big question. I mean, you were the paper boy, right? Now the question is, were you throwing the papers on the doorstep or were you messing with certain clients and putting it on the driveway?
No, I always tried to deliver them as close to the front.
You're pretty accurate.
I think I had a pretty good arm, number one. I think I've always taken pride in, you know, having been able to throw things and accuracy.
Did you break any windows?
I don't remember breaking any windows, no. Yeah. And also, you remember at the end of the month, you're going to get paid, and if you want to get a tip,
then the tip was the key.
Then your service better be on point, because if they're happening to walk into their lawn and get their paper that's now had the sprinklers go on and it's sopping wet, you know, they're probably not going to be as happy as if it's sitting on their front door and they can just barely open the door and grab it.
Oh, that's so funny. You know, we share something in common. I wasn't a paper boy. My older brother was. However, one of my first jobs in the summer, and I'll give you some context here, I really wanted to have a little 50cc Honda scooter, right? And my dad was like, listen, you know, if you want that, you're going to have to come up with half of it. So I'll meet you halfway. So they never bought me anything outright. It was always a, hey, we'll meet you halfway, but you're going to have to earn. And I really respect that now. I'm so thankful they never just sort of gave me blank checks. And I remember I wanted this little red Honda Spree, 50cc, right? And so at the time in Northern California, the paper up there in Santa Rosa is called the Press Democrat. And I was looking through the paper for a summer job, right? And I come across this thing like, you know, is basically make money, earn prizes, right? Call. And it was this guy who worked for the Press Democrat. And he would rally up a bunch of kids in a van. And that sounds like total, you know, red flag. Never do this nowadays, right? But he was a cool guy. His name was Alan. And he would pick us up and drop us off with newspapers in front of the Food for Less or grocery stores. And I was out there hustling newspapers, man. You know, much like you having to learn at a very young age how to interact with people, how to negotiate, how to sell, all those different things. And I look back now and I think, man, those were some of the highlights of my life. You know, where you get a chance to really cut your teeth, where you're nervous and you're not sure of yourself. And that's substantive, though. Those are things that translate years later, but you don't always understand it in that moment, right?
Yeah, you don't. But I think what you do understand is that you're working for a purpose.
Yeah.
Right. When you're like, when your father says, hey, you've got to earn half this money. So now every paper you sell or every day you're able to go out there, you're able to make a little bit, you're chipping away at that goal. Right. So every day you get a little closer. So I think those are times in our life where we learn the determination and we learn the tenacity to have a goal and to not lose, you know, not lose sight of the focus on that goal to be able to achieve it.
Yeah, I like that. So you had this long storied paper boy career, I take it. But I'd imagine at some point you stopped doing that because nowadays I don't think you're folding newspapers and delivering those anymore, right?
No, I don't do that anymore. Okay. I don't even know. Are there even newspapers anymore? Does anyone do that?
I think that's basically right there with the Blockbuster movie card. Yeah, I think those days are done, man. I think they're gone. So tell me about what happened next. You probably at this point now, what, 15, 16, and now things have changed.
So my next job, I started cutting people's lawns, actually. Yeah. I found a few neighbors need their lawns cut. I cut a deal with them.
Pun intended.
I got that.
You're quick with that.
To cut their grass, and then that kind of grew a little bit, and I found some other kids that I could pay them to do the work for me, and I could get more work, so I could kind of expand my little grass cutting empire. So that was kind of like my next job I did. But I've always been a hustler. I've always really enjoyed the art of business and the challenge of making money, not necessarily for even the value of the money itself,
right,
but the ability to try and find opportunity to try and create something special.
How old were you when you had your empire, your lawn mowing empire?
I was 14.
14? Was it innate in you that you understood that you could scale this business by hiring somebody else and paying them a wage and then marking it up? Was that innate in you, or was that something that your maybe a family member said, hey, what if you did this, you can grow?
No, it's always been innate in me. I will say, though, my mom's side of the family is very, very entrepreneurial, very, very business driven. My father's side of the family is quite the opposite. They're a lot more artistic. A lot simpler people.
Okay.
And my uncle Marvin, I always admired and would watch him do business. And he was always hustling, always doing deals. Was a fast talker. Always took care of people. Really, really great human being. Was always taking care of other people and helping out financially. I've been at restaurants, I can't count the amount of times, and watch him pay for people's meals and then them not even know, and just give the waiter, go, hey, see that couple over there? I want to take care of their meal. Please.
Wow.
More times I can count.
Yeah.
So I think watching him had an indirect influence on me growing up, because business has, those kind of opportunities have always just seemed natural to me. I remember a story. I think I was 15. I went to Big Bear to go snowboarding. My dad let me use his credit card to buy a lift ticket, and I realized I could buy student lift tickets for, I don't remember what the price was, call it $35.
Yeah.
And whereas a full price was like $50, 55, maybe 55.
Yeah.
So I would go up, buy 10 at a time, then I'd go to the parking lot and sell those $35 tickets to people who'd be paying $55 at like $48 and make $13. And all my friends were up there for a week to go snowboarding.
Right.
And they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, just go ride. I'll see you guys in 2 hours. And then 2 hours, I made like, I don't know, $1,200. I just kind of said, hey, that's this price. This is that price. It's always been kind of in my DNA to see the opportunity and go, how can I capitalize on this? And if I do that, I'll be able to pay for my riding for the week and take care of the cabin we're staying at, et cetera. So it's kind of always not something I've necessarily set out to do, but sometimes I just see the opportunity and it kind of just figure out how to capitalize on it.
So paperboy turned scalper.
Yeah,
I guess. Okay, so that takes things to the next level, right? Because not only do you have to purchase something, but then you got to have the confidence, if you will, to approach somebody in that you don't even know and try to sell them something. Did that come natural for you?
Well, interesting you asked that question. I was raised a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
I'm fifth generation. My great-great-grandfather started the second congregation ever in 18-something. So wow. I spent a lot
like
of...
You're OG.
Yeah.
Like okay.
My family goes back to the very beginning of that. So I spent a lot of time as a youth going door to door and dealing with people who would, you're knocking on their door on a Saturday at 9 a.m. talking about religion. So they want to be sleeping. They don't want to talk about God, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And here you are annoying them. So I grew up in that. I think that definitely gave me some of the tenacity, I'll use that word again, the tenacity to take risks and be a little more fearless than I would have been otherwise. So, so that's a kind of a little, I don't know if you knew that I was going to go there, but that kind of segued into.
I'm glad you did, because you know, it's interesting. I feel like, and you also talked about Marvin, right? And individuals like Marvin. And I feel like it's interesting when we're growing up, what we're exposed to, you know, and it could be people, it could be, you know, chores that we had to do, it could be little part-time jobs, all of these things, you know, really support who we end up becoming. And we pick up all these traits and these skills. Sometimes they're like taught to us, like, hey, do X, Y, and Z. But sometimes we also observe, much like you talked about with Marvin, which I assume you probably picked up a lot of the things that he did. And it's probably a part of who you are nowadays, too.
100%. I told him not very long ago that I think he probably had as much or more influence on who I became as a man as my own father. Because I was really close to him. Everyone used to always tell me growing up that you're just like your Uncle Marvin. You talk fast. You always do for other people. You know, you're a hustler.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard that, I don't know, 1,000 times growing up. I was just like him. And it was always like a rewarding thing to hear because I had so much admiration and respect for him.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it had a huge influence on the way I, you know, subconsciously on the way I operate and the way my mind operates.
It plays a major role. I've had similar situations with my mom and my grandpa who passed away some years ago. And I remember specifically when we were younger, we would, my grandpa would, you know, we'd want to go to Kmart or something, right? And at the time, the Kmart had like a substation sandwich inside of it in Santa Rosa. And I remember with going with tagging along with my grandma and grandpa, we'd walk into the Kmart to do some shopping. There'd usually be somebody that was out front, like a homeless person or something like that, right? And I remember each and every time, like clockwork, my grandpa, when we're checking out of Kmart, he'd go to that substation, he'd buy a big foot long, something to drink, whatever. We'd always walk out and he would just hand it to whoever it was at that time and kind of, you know, wish them well type of thing. And we'd be on our way. And it was never him saying, hey, you need to do this and this is the way you operate and you should act in your life. It was literally he, through his leadership and through his example, was laying this foundation that at a young age, I'm not tuned into that, but I'm obviously observing it. And it sounds like you had similar situations with Marvin.
Yeah, and I think those lessons are a lot more impactful than just someone telling you, hey, you should be generous, right? It's when someone does it and you watch the authenticity in them when they do it. You see the people who are affected by it, and you also see the joy that it brings them. Like, I know when I give to other people, I'm able to help out. That brings me way more joy than doing something for myself, because it's tremendous. It's a gift. It's actually, in some ways, it's almost selfish, because I'm doing it for them, but I'm also really kind of doing it for me, because it makes me feel amazing to be able to give to them. Yeah. So I think experiences where you do observe those things and you observe them in a more complete way than like reading something in a book.
Or 100%.
So I think seeing those type of experiences time and time again were, you know, definitely part of the items or part of the experiences that helped create the person I am.
Yeah. And it's all through observation. Yeah. Right? It all starts with somebody doing the right thing consistently over time around others and others picking up on that, which tells us that really anybody can choose to be a leader. Anybody can choose to do the right thing and do those things and accept the fact that you are going to influence some people around you. And people, quite frankly, are looking and craving that leadership, right?
That's what I was going to say. I say it's also a reminder of how powerful our actions can be. We don't know who's watching. I don't know that my uncle, when he was doing those things, had in the back of his mind, I hope Josiah's watching, or I hope, you know, so-and-so, my brother's with us a lot, I hope Jason's watching. You know, he was just doing what he felt was right, and he didn't know necessarily that it was going to create the different emotions and the different inspirations that it created in me. In the same way, our behavior, either positive or negative, can also have a big impact on people who are observing us, whether it's our children, whether it's people that we might have influence over, whether it's a stranger could watch an amazing act of kindness and be moved by it and be moved to, you know, pay it forward.
Yeah, it's so powerful. You know, I think about what you just said and I apply it to my day to day. And I think some things that I try to do, and it was instilled in me at a young age, probably like yourself, is I always felt like the two most important words were please and thank you, right? Showing gratitude and appreciation. Even in my relationship, I'll, you know, let's say my girlfriend does something nice for me or whatever, I'll say thank you or thank you for dinner. And sometimes they come across, oh, don't worry about it, no big deal. And yet I'm of the opinion like, no, I want you to know I appreciate you. Like, you don't have to do that, you know? So it's like this idea of treating everybody as a volunteer, right? Not having this expectation, but this sense of gratitude and appreciation, right?
That was a bit of an adjustment for us when we moved to California. I remember my parents being very mindful of the fact that a lot of the kids in California didn't have the manners that we were raised with. Because I was always taught to say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, right. Please, thank you. I mean, that wasn't even an option. If I don't want to get smacked upside the head, I better say those things, yeah, right?
I'm with you.
And if you ask my kids, I mean, the yes, please and thank you, rather, are the two things I drilled into them. You always say please and you always say thank you. So that was a big change for us when we moved to California. That wasn't present in the way that we were familiar with it. So my parents kind of doubled down on that. So just because we're here, you don't lose your respect and your manners, right? So that still to this day stays with me. And I've always been cognizant of making sure I try to always show appreciation for the things that I'm given.
Yeah. And you know, nowadays, I mean, obviously you and I both being in California, and I would agree with you, you know, and certainly it seems that mannerisms have been, you know, thrown out the window in many cases, but we have a chance every single day to, like, you know, be the leaders in those situations, right? And pay it forward to other people, down to even just holding the door open for people 100%. And saying, hey, I've got you. I had a situation recently where I went into a stop to get some gas and saw this gentleman walking up. And so I held the door. He's wearing a Raiders hat. You know, I had to rub him a little bit because I'm a Niners fan. And I said, even though you're a Raiders fan, I got you, man. You know, and he smiled, laughed. I opened the first door and it was like one of those double doors. And he's like, well, let me return the favor for you, brother. And he opened the door and I walked through and I said, all right, man, you have a great day. And I think to myself, number one, on a human level, that's fantastic. And that's how I want my days to be, where it just feels good and it's connected to people. And on the second level is that, you know, what did it do for him and how would he go about maybe treating others in his day? Like with that one interaction, it could change the trajectory of how he's feeling. Maybe he's having a rough day or a bad experience or something's going on in his life, right? And some other human stranger shown an act of kindness could pull him out of that, could lift his spirits, and maybe sets him on a different trajectory that now he goes and treats. So I feel like this stuff is contagious. And all it starts with is one individual showing some kindness towards another.
100%. And kindness is a choice.
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so simple.
It's simple.
It requires almost nothing to hold open a door for someone, just to smile, to say please, to say thank you. I always think about when I'm at a restaurant or if I'm going through like a shopping line.
Yeah.
Just having a pleasant interaction with either the waiter, the waitress, the person taking care of your, when you're cashing out, just engaging with them, saying something nice, something playful, something kind. It's so easy. And not only do they benefit, you actually benefit too, because it uplifts your spirit.
Yeah.
Because then you have this quick human interaction. Yeah. And we live in a world that's getting more and more digital, more and more the human connection is getting more and more removed, which drives me crazy. I think it's the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
But when you're able to have that brief human interaction, the more brief human interaction, the connections we can have during the day, the better our life's going to be and the lives that we touch. And you're totally right that it can change their trajectory of the day. And then that transfers to the next person and so on and so on. Who knows how many lives were actually impacted by you holding open the door, even though it was a Raiders fan. Right?
I mean, though it was a Raiders fan. I agree with you.
It could have gone 20 people forward. Maybe even reached another Niners fan.
I may have converted him. He may now be a 49ers fan. But you're 100% right on that. So it sounds like you had a remarkable foundation. Like you were provided at a young age a good platform to build. So let's talk about that growth. We obviously know about your successful enterprises as a young man in your teenage years. Let's talk about how you got into what you do nowadays, which is producing these magnificent works of art for beautiful homes around, you know, stone and tile and all sorts of things. Where did that all start?
So it all started, my father was a contractor part of his life. My uncles were contractors. My grandfather was a self-taught architect. So I grew up around construction, around that industry. And I always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then when I was 16 years old, I was doing homeschooling due to some like church related involvement. I decided to do homeschool, and I started to go to work because my parents didn't have a lot of money. They didn't do like very well financed. They did okay, but they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, they were live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
So I went to work, got a job from someone in the church who worked as a stucco contractor.
Okay.
And so it was just a job, just a way for me to pay for my truck and pay for my own clothes and kind of help support myself. And I didn't want to do stucco, but it was a job. So the second day on the job is a house in Dana Point. The tile contractor approached me and said, hey kid, can you read a tape measure? I looked at him kind of surprised, like, of course I can. Who can't read a tape measure?
Yeah.
And he said, my helper can't. Why don't you quit doing stucco? Come back to work for me tomorrow doing tile.
Yeah.
And I've always loved art. I've always been very creative. I love design. So tile seemed like a much better fit for me and what I loved compared to stucco. So right. I said, okay. So I quit doing stucco on day two. And the next day I came back to work for him doing tile.
How old were you?
I was 16.
16.
And I've always been a very aggressive learner. And so when I went to work for him as a helper, I just started asking him lots of questions. Like, why are we starting here? Why are we doing this? How do you do that cut? And just making lots of mental notes as to what all went into the trade, the different reasonings for the different techniques he was using, and just kind of trying to learn as much as I could. And after about a year of asking questions and making these mental notes, I felt like I had learned enough to try and take it on myself.
So after 1 year?
Yeah. So when I was 17, that's when I started my own company, Epic.
Wow. I mean, a lot happened in fast. You're basically like a sponge, like a human sponge. You absorb all this information. Like, all right, after 1 year, let's go.
Hey, life's short. You gotta get after it quickly.
You gotta get
right?
after it.
I just, once again, it was one of those things. I didn't have a plan. It just kind of came naturally. I knew I wasn't going to be this guy's helper forever.
But you're in high school at the time, right? Well,
yeah.
You're in high school, but are you still homeschooling?
I'm still
homeschooling.
I'm still homeschooling. I'm working, and then I'm doing schooling at night.
Yeah.
And then once I started Epic, I took my GED. So after 10th grade, I took my GED and started working full time.
What was your social life like at the time? Were you pretty insulated, or did you have some friends that just from the neighborhood?
I had friends from the neighborhood, and then I had a really active social life, like within the church.
Within the church.
Yeah, the church.
So most of your life kind of revolved around the church.
Most of my life, yeah. And all of my youth until my young adult life revolved around the church. It was kind of, it's kind of all you know, really, when you grow up in it and you have your whole family's involved in it. It's a pretty all-encompassing religion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember being in church, you know, where our family's Christian, and I remember the church keep you really busy, you know, there was a lot of fun stuff, you know, keeps you focused on the right things. Right. But a lot of fun in groups and movie nights and activities. And so I can see how the church can be a big part of that. So you had a social network, but it was, again, friends in the church type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I would play football with the kids in the neighborhood. My brother and I would go to the local park and play quite a bit. So we definitely had some friends outside of the church, but the church also, when you're trying to live a certain type of life and have a certain type of philosophy when it comes to your relationship with God and your morality, then, you know, they encourage you to associate with people who are like-minded.
Yep.
So if you're with kids who are cursing and smoking and you're not supposed to be doing either of those things, then they probably don't want you to hang out with kids who are going to support your goals.
No NWA mixtape in the house allowed.
At least not that they knew about.
you remember those covers, right? They had the big sticker we hated at that explicit lyrics, parental. You would cover it too if you needed. This is just too short. Don't worry about this, Mom. Okay. All right. So you were having some fun at least. I mean, but at a young age, you're business-minded. You're really focused on, hey, I want something bigger in life.
Yeah, I've always aspired. I say this, I guess, as humbly as I can. Like, I've always been a leader. It's always been in my DNA. I've always, not trying to tell people what to do, but I've always instinctively just wanted to lead, and to go.
Yeah.
Knew where I was going to go. I might not knew where I was exactly where the final destination was going to be, but I knew I was going to lead the way somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, there's no negative connotation associated with it. I think, quite frankly, that people crave leaders. They crave good leaders. And the benefit for you is that you had that solid foundation that you would enable you to become that great leader. So you obviously know how to read a tape measure. That landed you the job, right? You absorb all these skills over the course of a year. You start your business. I mean, did you have any mentors? I mean, how did you know how to get a business license, what license, or were you just simply asking questions enough where you could absorb that information and quickly respond and figure it out?
You know the expression, fake it till you make it?
Yeah.
That was me. And I say that kind of jokingly. Yeah. I definitely, anything I've ever done, I've wanted to do it right. My dad was a perfectionist.
Okay.
So I always was taught, if you're going to do something, do it right or don't do it. And I still, to this day, live by that philosophy. If I'm going to sweep a floor, when I walk away from that floor, I want that floor to look pristine. Like, I take personal pride in that. I'm not going to half-ass it and just try and do it and get out of there. No, if my job is to sweep this floor, that floor is going to look damn good when I'm done. I'm going to make sure of that. And so I've always had that passion for excellence and to try and be like a perfectionist. So that's kind of always been in me. I forgot what your first leading question was with that, though. But just had that leadership or that passion for.
Yeah, you just had the passion to lead. So it was really around this idea that after about a year, you're ready to rock and roll. And it was innate in you to kind of like start that path. Like you weren't afraid of it, obviously, and you were ready to get started, which is very different than a lot of people experience, because some people doubt their capabilities. There's some fears or some insecurities that kind of get in the way. But it doesn't seem like that was your story. Yours was one of like, I'm ready to go.
I feel like the one place in my life I've always been really completely fearless is business. I've never been afraid to write a check that was bigger than I thought I should, or to try and take on a project. And I say that I don't mean that where if a job was something I had no idea what I was doing, where it's going to take it, where I was being cavalier about it, being stupid, but where it was a big project, it was a stretch for me. But I was never scared of it.
You don't have a scarcity mindset.
No, definitely not. I don't. I want to try and challenge myself to take something on that might be a little bigger than what I'm prepared for. But I'll learn from it, you know. And I'll take on something that might be a stretch, but it's not something that's completely out of my reach, because I also don't want to fail and create future problems legally or by not doing a good job or not having the capacity to execute the project.
Yeah.
But I've always been pretty fearless when it comes to business, and so I knew early on, once I didn't want to be a helper forever, I wanted to be my own boss.
Yeah.
So when I felt comfortable enough, I felt like I'm going to figure this out. I didn't have a business plan. I hadn't finished high school. I always did well at school and was pretty smart, but I didn't have a business education at all. So, I went to local tile stores, told them who I was, told them I was a local tile setter, and at that time, I'm 17. I probably looked like I was 14. I had a lot of people weren't willing to trust me initially.
Sure.
So got some small projects, proved that I knew what I was talking about, and slowly started building my reputation.
And started from there. Did you throw any lift tickets into some of those deals to sweeten the pot? You could have had some leftover ones from the previous season.
I had some antique copies of the Daily Pilot.
I love it. And here's your copy of the Daily Pilot. So you start off on this journey of building your brand, Epic. And you're still doing it to this very day. But I would imagine it's very different now.
It's evolved quite a bit, Where we are now and the level that we're working at and the kind of homes we're doing, it's pretty incredible. I'm not the kind of person who sits back and basks in their glory type thing. Not that I've got a lot of glory to bask in, but I'm not like, certain people won't always pat themselves on the back. That's not my style.
Sure.
But every once in a while, I'll walk through our shop and I'll see, a ton of guys running around doing projects, and I'll see our trucks driving around, and I'll think, wow, it's crazy. It's some 17-year-old kid. Thought he could do tile, and then this is what's come out of that. So it's a lot different now than it was then. And I remember hiring my first employee was my brother.
Your brother?
It was my brother. It was my helper.
So that initially. Whole don't mix business and pleasure, family. You forget that.
Hey man, I went to the lowest hanging fruit, right?
Was he cheap labor?
He was for sure.
Okay.
And so he was my first helper. But when I actually hired my first non-family employee, I remember being really, really nervous because I took that responsibility very seriously. I thought, man, this guy's going to pay his rent because of my ability to provide him with a living.
Yeah.
He's going to feed his family. And I was like, shit, this is scary.
It can be stressful, right?
Yeah. And I told him, I said, I know I've got work for you this week. We'll see about next week. And fortunately, once that faucet was open. It never stopped. Yeah. And I was able to provide work and keep these guys going and then slowly build the company to what it is today. But it was definitely nerve-wracking, not because of me, but because I just worried I want to be able to take care of people. That's always been important to me.
And you can't always control the business that comes your way.
No, you can't. You know, I wasn't, like, you know, without a business education, you don't even know about all the cycles of the economy and, you know, what's coming and the next projected, you know, recession or whatever. I was just kind of just taking advantage of the opportunities as they came my way and trying to pursue new opportunities that I could figure out.
So how long did it take you before you moved away from sort of owner-operator to owner? Meaning you were no longer really involved with the day-to-day of doing the stonework yourself. You had a team now that was basically doing the things that you were doing in the beginning.
Yeah, so part of my story, when I was 19, I moved away. I moved to the Caribbean for a few years. I lived in the Virgin Islands for a year and then Puerto Rico for 2 years.
Well, that sounds terrible.
I went down there, basically was kind of bored in California, and a couple of my friends and I went down there, found a place that was related to the church that needed support.
Okay.
So we went down there kind of with
church support in the Caribbean.
It was actually a small island called Virgin Gorda. It's in the British Virgin Islands. And it's literally, it was like 3,500 people live there. It's tiny. It's 3 miles. Lived there for almost a year. Couldn't work there because it's British. And it cost more money to have the ability to work then. And we had saved up money. So we were really there supporting the church initially. Then all my roommates kind of end up bailing, go back to California. We'll move to New York. So then I knew I could work in Puerto Rico. So after about 9 months, I moved to Puerto Rico. And I did tile and stone. That's when my brother actually flew out. At that point, I was 20. My brother was 17. My parents let him, for some reason, after 11th grade, come fly out and live with me, which still to this day baffles my mind.
Yeah.
Because I'm shocked that that wasn't really their style. I was shocked when he asked them and they said, yeah. And so he lived with me for a year and a half in Puerto Rico, and we did tile and stone there.
Yeah.
And then I moved back to California, and that's when I really started building. So I was 21 when I moved back to California, and it took me about 2 to 3 years before I was no longer installing tiles.
2 to 3 years into the business.
Mm-hmm. And it was, and I've always really enjoyed physical labor. I enjoy, you know, being fit and being strong. I really enjoy, after a long day of work, like feeling physically like you'd really put in
put in a good day's work.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed that. So it was, not installing was necessary, because of the business was growing and needed my attention, and I didn't have the liberty to be an installer anymore. But so I would say probably once the business was really back here in California, probably about 2 to 3 years.
A couple of years. Was it hard for you to let go of that hands-on componentry? And I ask the question because in my experience, it's difficult for the owner-operator to let go and to trust a team in the process because they have feelings like they just can't do it as good as I can do it, or they're going to screw it up, or, you know, what if they get it wrong and it costs me a job and all those different things that come into play. Did you experience that, or were you trusting the process and knowing it will all work out?
I don't think I was as nervous about other people installing tile because pretty early on I hired people to work with me and I watched them install, and quite honestly, a lot of them were a lot more experienced, a lot more talented than I was. They were older than me. Okay. They had been doing it longer. So that wasn't so much, didn't create as much nervousness in me. What did create nervousness in me was when I decided to hand over some of the bidding of the projects, when I handed over the checkbook, because I would drive around with the checkbook and, you know, write checks for the materials, the thin sets, the tile, everything we needed. I mean, I was the, you know.
You're still your procurement manager.
Yeah, I was wearing a lot of hats. So when I finally handed that over, my mom was the first one to help me with my books. And
here we go again with the inexpensive labor. I'm right? Recognizing the pattern with you.
Yeah.
That's smart.
That's Southern charm at work for you. Keep it in the family.
I like that.
Yeah, so she helped me do the books, and just not having that control, like even not even from like a control aspect, but if I needed something, then she had to cut the check. I had a checkbook with me, and just there was so many different things to my head that I wasn't quite ready for. I had to adjust to that concept and that part of growth that everyone goes through.
Yeah.
So that, and then also probably one of the biggest ones for me was when I handed over estimating, because now you've got someone helping you. Because for a long time, when I wasn't doing the actual installation,
right,
I'm overseeing the jobs. Then I'd come to the office in the afternoon, the office being my home, and bid projects, go through plans, put together all the estimates. And when the growth point where I needed to hand that off to someone else was really scary, because now you've got someone else who's calculating this whole project,
right,
putting a number on it, and I'm signing a contract. So I either have to A, go back and check everything he did, mm-hmm, and make sure that it's accurate, or B, trust him that he did it. And there's a little bit of both. You're probably, some checks and balances initially, but that was scary, really scary, because you're committing to something that hopefully you got it right.
Right. And I would imagine it would be a little bit difficult turning over one of the functions that you probably excel in, which is being the face and the voice of the organization and being able to sell, like you are the product, right? In many ways, like your ability, much like at the ski lift in Big Bear, where you're approaching people and saying, hey, I've got a deal for you, would you like to buy this? In some ways, you're turning it over to somebody else and trusting them to be able to close those deals, which basically feeds your staff, right? Which you also are concerned about, because you need to bring those deals into the business to keep those paychecks flowing to support everybody.
And at that point, I was still pretty much the face. So he was doing more of the behind the scenes estimating. I would go out, I was more handling more of the relationships. I was more client facing, and he was handling the plans and going through everything and doing all my takeoffs and putting all the costs together. So it was a combination, but yeah, all of those components are definitely parts of growth that we all have to go through, but it's definitely nerve-wracking.
Yeah. So looking at where you're at today and where you want to take the organization, what's next on the horizon for you? Because obviously you've had a tremendous amount of success. You've been doing this for many years. It's clear to me that you're still very passionate about it. No different than you were when you were 17 years of age. You're still waking up with fire in your belly. You're at it. You're up and at it, as they say. Where do you see you on a personal level, as well as Epic and some of your other brands, at long-term?
Well, we have a tremendous amount of opportunity on the table for Epic from our reputation. Mm-hmm. We have people wanting us to expand to other communities. I think we have a really good opportunity to expand, open up a second shop in Palm Springs, which we're looking into. There's a tremendous amount of work being done out there, really high-end homes.
Yeah.
And we have some opportunities already, projects that we're working on. So we're really looking at that really seriously, potentially buying another shop and then kind of turning it into an Epic shop with our culture and our techniques that we have mastered or are continuing to master here, I should say.
Yeah.
So I think we just want to continue to elevate the brand. I think that's something I've really focused on in the last year or two specifically, to really help clients understand. We've done it through a lot through social media, but to help them understand that when you hire Epic, what that means,
right,
that not all, just as every car is not the same, just like every steak's not the same, there's all different levels, different amounts, different quality, different service that comes with different elements you purchase,
right.
Same thing, not every tile or stone company is the same, and when you work with Epic, the quality, the passion, the team that's behind it, our commitment to excellence, help clients understand that. So I want to continue to elevate the brand. We're wanting to do more and more bespoke projects,
yeah,
where everything is really, really unique. I'm looking into some different opportunities where we can be buying blocks of stone and like literally cutting the tile and slabs from the same block of stone to make sure that there's just perfect harmony in the way all the materials come together. So I've got some different ideas I'm working on. Really passionate about design.
Yeah.
For my own personal brand, I would love to focus on being more of a bespoke stone designer.
Okay.
And that could encompass furniture. It could encompass...
with the materials that you currently work with. Let's say stone, for example.
Right. With materials I work with, also some wood, some steel. There's some other things I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
But definitely my passion is stone. I love traveling. I've been able to travel a lot due to Epic, create some really amazing relationships around the world from different factories and different countries I've gone to and different quarries, which has been such a rewarding experience. Mm-hmm. Never realized when I was 17 that that the stone business would take me to Italy and Portugal and different parts of Central America and South America and Brazil. And,
yeah,
you know, I've done a lot of traveling, and it's been so rewarding, and it's a privilege to work with Mother Nature's art. You know, it's not
like gorgeous.
We're doing nothing against drywall, but there's other parts of the construction process that aren't as beautiful and aesthetically pleasing,
right,
as stone is. And for me, it's literally Mother Nature's art. And so to be able to take that and work with it and then transform that into these incredible environments that our clients get to enjoy and gets to be the place where they feed their child, where they bathe their child, where right. their families eat, like where these amazing experiences happen
yeah.
in the environments that we help create, it's a really incredible privilege and something that still fires me up every day.
Yeah, that's remarkable. You know, there's an interesting translation that I'm kind of picking up on here, which is ever since you were just a young man kind of getting started, that you wanted to lead. And you wanted to lead in your personal life and you wanted to lead others around you, but it also sounds like you want to lead the industry. Like you want to show some leadership in the industry and what it could be and how it should be, from how passionate we ought to be about the craft, the perfectionism in the craft, right? Which elevates everybody. It elevates you, elevates your team, elevates the people that are exposed to the content that Epic puts out there. And it's interesting, right? Because it's kind of the personal element being carried and projected outward towards the others, in which you'll lift and inspire some people.
I think, yes, I agree with what you said. And I think the two areas I'm probably most passionate about when it comes to leading is leading in the sense of how our respect for the materials. Right? Yeah. Unlike a stone quarry, when a quarry is gone, and there are plenty of quarries throughout the time that are no longer available, unlike a tree, we cut down a tree, you can plant another tree, and it's not, the sustainability is very different when it comes to stone.
Right.
Because when those resources are gone, they're gone. You can't plant another Calcutta quarry of marble, right? It's done.
Right.
So when we fabricate, I want to view that material as a precious commodity. Mm. And if you're fabricating carelessly and it's something that then after installation looks like crap and you've got needs to be demoed, then you've just disrespected Mother Nature and Earth and this precious commodity that you didn't take serious. So I want to be exemplary and how we treat and view that resource. That's one way.
Yeah.
And the other way is I want to lead by the way I treat my people, right? My family. And we always talk about, you know, our values at Epic, our family, passion, and excellence. And family comes at the top of that list.
Right.
Because we truly operate as a family. I've had employees tell me, hey, I've never seen a company operate like this before. I've heard this many times that, you know, you say this, that people say they're a family, but here we live it, you know,
right.
Whether we've helped people, you know, help them, give them money to get their citizenship, to
yeah.
buy a house, to help them, you know, they had a career where they could start a family. And I have so much appreciation
right.
for the people that work at Epic that it means a lot to me. My guys have seen me get emotional many times with talking
yeah.
to them about how much they mean to me. And it's an honor to have people that are willing to work for you. And I've got employees who have been here for over 20 years. I got a lot of them who have been over 20 years. So to have them, you know, have shared so much of their life with me
yeah.
and with Epic, I take that as a real testament to the company and hopefully the kind of leader that I am. To what either I've tricked them with some good Kool-Aid so they're still here after 20 years or they're trapped here, but I think they're here by choice, and I take that as a testament to the type of leader I strive to be.
Yeah, and you can definitely see and feel that when you're in your facility and for the people that are around you. And you're right, you know, it's interesting, right? Because when you think about it, when you first started the business, it was because you had a passion for, you know, doing the work and maybe earning some income and having a different lifestyle and stuff. But now it's gotten to the point where it's much bigger than that. It's beyond the transaction, right? You've now touched on the human element, the human soul, the human being componentry that will transcend and live on beyond the stone itself.
And we've built relationships not only with our employees, but also with our clients.
Yeah.
We've had clients whose homes, we just finished a project last year, and we did this client's previous home 20 years ago. And she came back, and her builder had his own tile crew, a couple of different companies he worked with, yeah. Epic not being one of them. And she reached out to me and said, Josiah, you guys did my last house 20 years ago. The work still looks amazing. You guys have to do my house. And we came back and looked at her, the other proposals, and kind of figured out what we could do. And we ended up doing the house. And it's just really, really cool to have someone be that intent on working with you again 20 years after you did their project. And that's happened on more than one occasion. And I've got a lot of these clients that where I've become friends with. So not only do I get to develop these amazing relationships and from different factories and quarries around the world with my employees, but also with our clients. And all that's been just due to a 17-year-old kid know how to read a tape measure.
I love that. So before we wrap this up, what advice would you give to somebody that's listening to this, that's in the industry, that's the 17-year-old right now, that's just starting out? And not necessarily 17, maybe they're 18, but right? But the person that's starting out on this journey that you've lived and that you're continuing on with, what advice would you give them when you summarize everything that you've learned over these years? What would you tell that person?
I would say, don't be afraid to take chances. No, they should be educated risk. I'm not saying be careless, but be willing to fail. Be willing to take some risks, to take some chances. Find your passion. Like, I always knew I wanted to do, once I got into this industry, I knew I would always be doing high-end custom work. I never wanted to do commercial work, production, could have been bigger dollars, bigger volume. I don't care about that. I wanted to do things where I walk in those bathrooms, I'm blown away at the quality that my team produced. So I've always known that about myself. I love that passion. I love that quality. I love that challenge has always been there. So know who you truly are, because then if you find that passion, then it's never really a job, right? You're doing what you love, and you get rewarded every day you go to work. There's plenty of days that suck and shit goes sideways. Don't get me wrong. It's not all perfect, but what brings you back is doing what you love, and knowing that you will find those great days far outweigh the negative ones, and being willing to take risks. And if you fail, guess what? Then you just learn from it, and now it refines you a little bit. So the next choice you make in that business will be a little bit better.
Josiah, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Take care.